Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. Prosecutors in Donald Trump's unprecedented criminal trial have told the court in New York he orchestrated a conspiracy and a cover-up. Mr. Trump denies falsifying business records to hide payments of hush money to a porn actress before the 2016 presidential election. Neda Taufik reports from New York.
Prosecutors told jurors this case was about a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up. They set the scene, reading out excerpts from the infamous Access Hollywood tape, where Donald Trump bragged that because he was famous, he could grab women by their genitals. They set on the heels of that another story about sexual infidelity, especially with a porn star, would have been devastating for the campaign. Prosecutors said the hush money payment was election fraud pure and simple, and to cover it up, Trump lied over and over again on business records. The former president's lawyer, Todd Blanche, told jurors his client was not personally involved in any of this, and that there was nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy, he said.
Police in Ecuador have captured the fugitive leader of a powerful criminal gang, Los Lobos, which has played a major part in destabilizing the country. Fabricio Colon Pico had been on the run since January. Clitzia Sala reports.
Fabricio Colon Pico had dyed his hair blonde in an attempt to change his appearance. It took police more than 4 months to trace him to the town of Puerto Quito. The 44-year-old was one of the most wanted people in Ecuador. On the 8th of January, he escaped from jail alongside 30 other prisoners during a major riot. Ecuador's Attorney General, Diana Salazar, accused Colon Pico of plotting to kill her and of planning last year's murder of the presidential candidate, Fernando Villavicencio.
The authorities in Mexico have arrested the brother of one of the most powerful drug lords in the country. Abraham Oseguera was detained on Sunday by the National Guard in the state of Jalisco in central Mexico. Oseguera's brother is the leader of one of the most prominent criminal gangs in the country. An independent review of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has said Israel has yet to provide evidence for its claim that a significant number of UN staff were members of terrorist organizations. Here's Imogen Folks.
This long-awaited report says UNRWA needs to improve its neutrality, its staff vetting, and its transparency. But it adds UNRWA operates in a highly challenging environment. Many donor countries suspended their funding after Israel's allegations. But this report describes UNRWA as indispensable for Palestinians. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has accepted the report's findings, and UNRWA has pledged to implement its recommendations.
Imogen Folks, you're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The European Commission has threatened to suspend a feature on TikTok's Light app because of concerns that it could be addictive. The rewards program gives users prizes for watching and liking videos. Regulators believe the program could damage the mental health of users, particularly children, and say unless TikTok provides a risk assessment quickly, it will be fined. The jailed Iranian Nobel Peace Prize winner, Narges Mohammadi, has urged Iranians to protest against a new campaign to force women to wear headscarves. She said the sometimes violent arrests now being carried out by the country's morality police amounted to a full-scale war against women. Under the Islamic Republic's strict dress code, Iranian women are required to cover their hair. Ms. Mohammadi has spent much of the last 2 decades in jail. African leaders at a security summit in Nigeria have called for the setting up of a regional standby force and greater control over peacekeeping efforts. Nigeria's national security advisor, who organised the two-day event, said it aimed to focus on finding African-led solutions to insecurity. The African Union says there are 8 attacks by extremist groups every day, leading to 44 deaths across the continent. A zoo in the Netherlands says 5 raccoons are still on the loose a month after escaping from their enclosure. Keepers at the Aqua Zoo in Leeuwarden are trying to tempt them back with marshmallows and strawberry juice. 6 have already been recaptured. The zoo's manager, Jeroen Lumeyer, says they've gone to quite extreme lengths to try and capture them.
The police assisted us with drones, with heat cameras, and they can see all kind of animals like ducks, like seagulls, but no raccoons. We patrolled at night with night vision, with infrared cameras, and some local people helped us. They stayed up during the night. They saw like deers and otters and a beaver. They really had good nights seeing all those animals, but no raccoons.
And that's the latest BBC News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to
place. Welcome to A Public Affair and Happy Earth Day. I'm Douglas Haynes, your Monday host. It's National Poetry Month, and to celebrate, we're hosting a roundtable conversation today on poetry and community in Wisconsin. As Wisconsin poet laureate Nicholas Gulick writes, poetry at its best breathes life into communities because poetry is, in essence, a deeply communal act. I'm delighted to have Nicholas Gulick on the show today, along with 2 other award-winning poets committed to creating community through poetry. I'll introduce them one by one here. With us, we have Kimberly Blazer, past Wisconsin Poet Laureate and Professor Emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's the author of 6 poetry collections and the founding director of INNAPO, Indigenous Nations Poets. Welcome to A Public Affair, Kimberly.
Thank you so much, Douglas. It's delighted to be here.
Great to have you. And also with us is Stephen Espada Dawson, Poet Laureate of Madison, editor and educator. His poems have appeared in many journals, and he was a 2022-2023 fellow in poetry at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks for having me, Douglas. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, great to have you for this conversation, too. And of course, also, as I said at the top, we have with us today Nicholas Gulick, Poet Laureate of Wisconsin for 2023-2024. He's the author of 3 books of poems and is Associate Professor of Languages and Literatures at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Thanks for joining us, Nicholas.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And welcome to all of you listening today. If you'd like to share a celebration of poetry or a favorite poem or have a question for present and past Poets Laureate with us today, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to hear from you and especially hear from you about what poetry means to you or how poetry helps connect you with community. As a starting point, here in National Poetry Month, I thought it would be great to have all of you introduce yourselves by way of your work, by way of your poetry a little bit. And in particular, poems that have been meaningful to share for you at public events, in your public roles as Poets Laureate, and what it means to you to share these poems. So we'll go back to the first person I introduced, Kimberly Blazer, to start with you today, Kimberly. And you have a poem to share for us with us to get us started here today, Kimberly?
Yes, I'd love to share a poem called The Where in My Belly. Scientists say my brain and heart are 73% water. They underestimate me. A small island, Minas, I emerged among Minnesota's northern lakes, the where of Monoman, wild rice in my belly. I am from boats and canoes and kayaks, from tribal ghosts who rise at dawn, dance like wisps of fog on water. My where is White Earth Nation and white pine forests, knees summer stained with blueberries, pink lady slippers open and wild as my feet. I grew up where math was Canasta, where we recited times tables while ice fishing at 20 below, spent nights whistling to northern lights. I am from old, medicine barks and teas, from early, the air damp with cedar, the crack of a mick, beaver tails on water. Their echo now, a warning to where fish become a percentage of mercury, become a poison statistic, to where copper mines back against a million blue acres of sacred. I am from Nabe and Ogechi Dakweg, women warriors and water protectors, from seed gatherers and song makers, the wet, where pulse in my belly whispers and repeats, like the endless chant of waves on ledge rock, waves on ledge rock, on ledge rock, on waves, on water, Nupi.
Thank you, Kimberly. Wonderful. Yeah. Everybody's clapping and smiling here with me. What a wonderful introduction, not only to you, but our theme of community and so many communities, both human and more than human, unfolding in that poem. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's called The Where in My Belly, right?
Right. Correct.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just going to continue on here as these poetic introductions continue. Let's go to you next, Stephen Espada Dawson, Poet Laureate of Madison. What do you have for us?
Thank you. This one's titled, When My Brother Visits, We Play Hide and Seek. When my brother visits, we play hide and seek with Santiago's VCR. The black ribbon of como agua para chocolate still treadmilling inside. If the new kid is working the pawn shop, we'll have enough to split pioneer chicken. Fryer grease baptizing our knuckles. Next week, we'll lift a fistful of Tio's dirt weed, his rocking chair cure for foggy eyes. Then mom's grocery bag stash of laundromat quarters. Gravity stretched it thin enough to see the tidy stacks of guillotined fathers. Us less scared of La Jura, more scared of her. Only one we knew could square up and make even God flinch. My brother and me practiced hiding so much, we eventually lost each other. Him paddling down any river that end at the tributary below a tourniquet. I learned you can lose yourself in someone else's losing. It took a dozen years of feeling around in the dark for me to find a family photo with everyone in frame. When I saw it, my eyes fogged too. In my periphery, I saw my mom firing pearls from a slingshot. One by one, she's got a target in mind but won't say who. I see them pass through the sky like a needle through denim. I'm still waiting for them to land.
Thank you. That's Madison Poet Laureate Stephen Espada Dawson with the name of the poem again, Stephen.
When my brother visits, we play hide and seek.
Thank you. And again, applause and smiles here on our end of the radio. Another great introduction, not only to you, but so many communities interwoven into that poem. Thank you. And we'll go now to Nicholas Gulig, Wisconsin Poet Laureate, for your introduction via a poem today.
I'd like to read a poem called Of Genesis. The origin of every book is laws. There's not a word in the beginning, and language always listens to its end. Tell me what has left its mark upon the names you give to stars you cannot see, and I will try to break the sentence into something strange enough to trust. Look, the world is blue as death down here already, The air is poisoned by our breath. It's getting difficult to teach our children how to speak by speaking.
Thank you, Nicholas Gulig of Genesis. And I felt my own breath sort of stop there for a moment at the end. It's getting difficult to teach our children how to speak by speaking is the last line, right, Nicholas?
That's correct.
So many ways we can use that as a jumping off point to talk about language, both connecting us and sometimes the failures of language to connect us, right? Let's transition from these beautiful introductions to thinking about poetry and community and how poetry creates community. And here's some of your stories from being both out and about in your public roles as Poets Laureate, but also all of you are teachers as well. So I know that that is a way that poetry connects people as well. So I'm going to just cycle back here to you, Kimberly, and start with this broad question. And if you want to respond to the poems as a way into that question as well, that's great as well.
So I think that almost we could say the purpose of poetry is to create community, because it arises out of the oral, the song, and it is always offering an invitation. And I used to give myself this little pep talk when I would, before public events, and I would say, it's not about you, it's not about you, it's about making connections, it's about the community, it's about sending the poem into the world. And I have a story to tell about a poem that I sent into the world. So when Indigenous Nations poets had their first mentoring retreat in DC, we had a closing reading. And then we had a dance party with Joy Harjo, who was closing out her term as U.S. Poet Laureate. And I read a poem that I had dedicated to Nathan Phillips, who was the Indigenous man who had been drumming on the mall in D.C. and was confronted by the youth and with the MAGA hats. And he just continued to drum. So when a friend of mine had invited me to write a poem on dignity as an endangered species, my mind went back to him. And I thought that he was incredibly dignified in that moment. And though I don't even mention him in this poem beyond the dedication, it is about that, like, how do we hold dignity in difficult circumstances? And who are teachers, some of which I believe are more than human beings. And so anyway, I had read this poem in our closing reading. We were dancing like crazy people, and then we were about to leave. And two of my INAPO fellows came and said, the man you read that poem for is here. And I was like, what? And so then I went and found him and introduced myself. And I had exactly two things on me, the book that I read from and my purse, because we came directly from the reading to the dance party. So I didn't want to have much. So then I just told him how much I admired him, his, you know, dignity, and how I had written this poem that I dedicated to him. And he also had some youth with them. So he was also creating his own community. And they said, can you read it to him? So we're standing there with a capital behind us. It's this beautiful night. I read in the poem. And it is just this transforming moment when poetry goes out in the world and finds its own way. And so then, having done this, I was late for dinner. And when I arrived, I told everyone about this. And one of the people at the dinner said, oh, that was such serendipity. And Lucy Tapahatsa, who is the inaugural Diné, or Navajo Poet Laureate, said, that was not serendipity. The spirits were all over that. But it's just the way that we do send our poems into the world, and they go off on their own, and other people pick them up, and they do whatever they do with them. And a lot of times we leave in our poetry a space for that to happen. You know, our poems don't say everything that's possible, because we'd like to leave room for other people to enter and help us make meaning.
Stephen, I'll turn it to you to respond, enhance, add to what Kimberly just said, your own stories.
I don't know if I can enhance that at all. that was great. I think most people who don't read a lot of poetry think that maybe the epitome of poetry is what's inside of like a Hallmark card. And believe me, I used to think that way too. So I think people are constantly being surprised, like what can happen in a poem. For me, poetry really is the most potent way that people can imagine the world or their circumstances differently, or reimagine their circumstances differently, right? And when I say potent, I really mean it. I mean, this is something that you could put in your pocket, right? This is so often the form asks us to contain so much in so little, right? I mean, I have a ton of stories, but I think recently something that really struck me, I was teaching a workshop through the Odyssey program at UW-Madison, and this program specifically worked with non-traditional college students, students that are coming back to college after, you know, already living a life, you know, already having families. Maybe some of them are formerly incarcerated, you know, just non-traditional in that way. And this is at first a little bit of an awkward class because they don't really know each other that well. And they're already being sort of like in an unfamiliar environment, you know, in an academic space that can sometimes be, frankly, a little sterile, right? But the way that they were able to share their experience through poetry, even as first-time writers of it, you could really see the light switch flick on, this sort of like shared empathy, the like, I see you moment. We are connected. And I understand that now. That really is such a, it doesn't get old, really. And it's so much better than publishing or whatever. it's like the real deal. So.
Thanks for sharing that moment, Stephen. I'm going to jump in with station ID, remind everyone what you're listening to, and then we'll go to Nicholas next. So you're listening to A Public Affair today here on WORT 89.9 FM. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking with Wisconsin Poet Laureate Nicholas Gulick, Madison Poet Laureate Stephen Espada Dawson, and former Wisconsin Poet Laureate Kimberly Blazer. If you'd like to share a celebration of poetry today, a favorite poem, have a question for my Poets Laureate guests, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We're talking especially about poetry and community and how poetry connects us to communities. And we'll go right back to you then, Nicholas, to talk about that a little bit in your own experience, how poetry has connected you to communities.
Yes, yeah, as I was sitting there, like the rest of the audience, listening to Kim and listening to Stephen talk about poetry, I was reminded of there's an essay called "The Rejection of Closure" by the late poet Lynn Hegenian, which is an essay that I sometimes teach to upper division poetry students, and whose argument I try to kind of reframe in other ways when I'm teaching to introductory poetry students. And a lot of what both Kim and Stephen were saying reminded me of the Lynn Hegenian essay. In that essay, she argues for an open ending as opposed to a closed ending at the end of a poem. And what she's saying, I think, is akin to what Stephen is talking about, or kind of maybe it's when Stephen is talking about, well, people, there's this narrative that the Hallmark card epitomizes what a poem is. And I think Hegenian would reject that, like in much the same way that Stephen does. And that's what she's referring to as a closed ending, an utterance that closes down the conversation, an utterance that claims to have answered the question or define the sentiment thoroughly or something like that. And what she's arguing for instead is an open ending where there is something left undisclosed, where there is something, there's still mystery that remains at the end of the poem. And for Hijinian, I believe that that creates the space that Kim is talking about when Kim is talking about how the poem is something that we give to the reader and that the reader kind of steps in once the poem has been offered to them and the reader comes in and completes the poem with whatever kind of interpretive creative energies or forces or whatever that they have to bring to it. If the poem is closed, there's no room for that reader to do any kind of work. There's nothing for the reader to do. When a poem is closed or when an utterance is closed, the reader becomes powerless in a way. The reader becomes a kind of passive receptacle of information. All the power is rooted in the speaker, right? I have something to say. I have a truth that I understand and I'm going to kind of impose it upon you. I think poetry is at its best resists that as much as it can in order to make room for the creative capacities of people who are not the poet, for people who are the readers. And I think poetry at its best is a effort to kind of provide people the opportunity to be co-creators in this thing called the poem that we're making. And so I think Kim and Stephen did a really good job of kind of highlighting those dynamics.
That it's really an interactive process that a poem sparks is what you're describing, Nicholas. And I heard that in Stephen and Kimberly's work as well. And a few other words jumped out at me. Kim's focus on dignity and the dignity that comes through that shared experience of the poem. You use the word offering, Nicholas, that this is a sort of gift that the poet is giving or putting out there into the world. And you use the terms shared empathy, Stephen, to talk about that process of what happens when people come together through a poem. And this is something that you have all signed up for in a particular capacity as poets laureate. And that's something that goes beyond the page or the creation of the poem itself and putting the poem into the world. You're inhabiting now this public role, or for you, Kimberly, in the past and now with Wisconsin Poet Laureate and now with Indigenous Nations poets, you're doing it in a different capacity. But how do you see those public roles as extensions of what you're doing as poets in the ways that you just described that interaction you're hoping to create as poets? Let's talk about your public roles a little bit, and feel free to get as concrete as you'd like in terms of your individual interests and initiatives as past and present poets laureate. We'll go back to you, Kimberly.
Sure. I'm really interested in collaborative writing, for example, or community poems. I was involved with this beautiful community poem last year with WIC Poetry and AGU, which is American Geophysical Union. And it was also kind of that edge where we're looking at the way that arts and science are not different, but they're both engaged in inquiry, which goes back to what we were saying about, you know, that the poem is searching and that the poem asks questions and so forth. So I'm really interested in that part of engaging with community, is when you can actually invite people into the literal writing of the poem with other poets. And I'm going to do something with Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets around that. I think it's in June So keep an eye out for that. But the other thing, when I was Wisconsin Poet Laureate, I did a recitation challenge. So I feel like poetry recitation is kind of a lost art, and I wanted to try to revive that, but I didn't want people just necessarily sitting in their library reciting to themselves. So we had these community events where everyone came out and they had a poem memorized. And there was one event that I remember as being just fabulous, where we had to actually put a chair by the mic because the little girl who was going to recite a poem was too short to reach the mic. And then there was an 86-year-old man on the other end of the spectrum. But at one point, I remember we had like 32 people coming out and reciting poems. And it's just a really lovely experience, because when you memorize a poem, it inhabits you in a different way and you inhabit the poem. But there was a moment at the end of another event when people would had kind of, I had just in the middle of my reading had asked people to talk about or share lines from their favorite poem. And somebody in the back of the room was talking about one of Shakespeare's poems, sonnets. It was there a second ago, but it's the Love Is Not Love, which alters when it alteration finds. I can't remember the number right now. But anyway, he said that he knew this. And so I whispered to him, let's do it together. So if you've ever recited with someone where you do alternating lines, that's way, way harder than simply reciting the poem. But we did that spontaneously. We hadn't planned it. We both did it. And then I sort of whispered off the mic again to him to finish together. And it was just this really lovely creating of a moment. And so I kind of love that when it's like a poetry flash mob, when people bring their favorite poems or their lines or whatever, just kind of together, just in a conversation. So that, of course, is one of the things. And I don't want to monopolize the time, so I can talk about N.A. Poe in a further question.
Sure. Yeah, we'll do that. And I loved hearing about that reviving lost art, the lost art of recitation. And I often struggle with my own students about how much I should kind of push that. But every time I have, I've found that it's valuable in the ways that you describe. And I love the idea of collaborative recitation as well. So that would be something fun to try, not only in a classroom context, but just with other folks or with kids or whatever. Let's go to you, Stephen. Tell us more about your thoughts on putting poetry and community in practice. How are you doing that these days as a Madison Poet Laureate?
Yeah. So I've only been the Madison Poet Laureate for a couple months, so bear with me on that in that respect. But I really am trying to be poetry's cheerleader in Madison. While also understanding the limitations of poetry. So I will, you know, read at events and give workshops and serve on committees and things like that. But going back to sort of like the limitations here, and then I'll sort of like switch back to what I think is possible. I'm unconvinced that writing a poem is action, right? You can't feed refugees of genocide with a sonnet, for example, right? But I think it can lead to action, or at the very least, invite us to consider the power of language. And the language really is the cartilage between all weapons, right? So I'm thinking about that a lot in my tenure as Poet Laureate here. And I really want to make it my goal in the next couple of years to serve the underdog. And what I have planned is really working primarily with justice impacted communities, currently incarcerated folks. And so what can I bring from the inside, right? What can I bring from there to share with the outside? So many people that are in jails, in prisons, they don't think that they can affect the external world anymore, right? And the umbrella, the shadow of incarceration is even bigger than just that individual, right? We're talking families here, right? So I'm really interested in creating something shared between those communities and how that can live on the outside, either as a series of readings or an anthology, or something like that. That's sort of like what I have planned.
Thanks, Stephen. Yeah, sounds great. I was thinking about, as I was listening to you, having the experience just the other day of seeing some of Angie Trudell Vasquez's poems on the sidewalk by a bus stop the other day, you know, inscribed into the sidewalk, and how that was such a great venue for people who already paused in their daily life for a moment, right, to connect with somebody in a very different situation, and how great it would be to have voices, as you're saying, from people, say, inside incarcerated institutions in that space where we could connect with somebody else's experience while we're kind of in a slowdown or a pause moment of our daily lives. Poems on buses, too, have been great ways to see that. I've enjoyed that, too. Let's hear your experiences and ideas as well, Nicholas Skulig.
Yeah, two things come to mind listening to Stephen and Kim again. They're such wonderful people to sit and talk with. When Stephen was talking about prisons, I was thinking about like using poetry as a way to give people who are quite literally physically cut off from the rest of the community. I was thinking about a friend of mine who spent 3 years in prison, whose story and whose narrative has found its way into my work every once in a while. And I went to visit him he was in Ohio. And I went to go visit him in Lisbon, Ohio, while he was incarcerated. And we were talking, and you know, I hadn't seen him in some time because he had been in prison. And I remember I asked him, like, what's the thing that surprises you? Like, what are you most surprised by being here? And he said, I was shocked at the levels of illiteracy that are present in this community. So many of the people that he was with, his cellmate, for example, couldn't read and couldn't write. And because he was highly educated, he was in the middle of a PhD program when he went to prison. And part of his plea bargain, I suppose, involved a stipulation where he was allowed to continue his studies, but from prison. So every month, his professors would fly from New York and bring him more books, and he would give back the old books, and they would give him more books, and he had a stipulation on the amount of objects that he could have in his cell. For the majority of prisoners, it's a very, very limited amount of number, but because he needed to continue or was able to continue his studies, he was able to have an unlimited amount of books. And so he quickly became somewhat known within the community because he had all of the weights in the prison. It was no longer legal for prisoners to have access to weight rooms, and so they improvise and they collect all their books together and put them in laundry bags and tie their laundry bags to broom handles and make these kind of impromptu weight rooms. And my friend had an unlimited amount of weights, and so he quickly became known as not only the person who had weights, but also the person, because he had so many books, like, oh, this person can read, this person can write. And he quickly became the person that the other inmates would turn to in order to write letters to their girlfriends, in order to write letters to their children, in order to read letters from their wives, from their girlfriends, from their children. And he often said that being literate is kind of what saved him there, that it became a kind of protection because he was white. And so he kind of didn't really fit in with either of the kind of racial kind of castes or classes that tend to form in prisons, because he didn't really want to spend any time with the white supremacists who were in prison, but he also wasn't very welcome in like the brown groups or in the black groups. But because he could help them read their letters and help them write their letters, and because he had these books that everyone could use as weights, he kind of was taken in and protected by all the different groups in prison. And so in this weird, strange way, language was this vehicle for him that allowed for those kinds of kind of community building activities, whether it's letter writing, letter reading, or
lifting weights. It became this thing that he credits with kind of saving him, with protecting his physical person in a pretty dangerous situation.
Thank you, Nicholas. I love the image of people lifting weights with the Norton Anthology of Poetry or something, big fat book.
Yeah.
I should remind everyone that you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Wisconsin Poet Laureate Nicholas Gulick, Madison Poet Laureate Stephen Espada Dawson, and former Wisconsin Poet Laureate Kimberly Blazer. We're talking about community and poetry and how poetry connects us. It's an all-around celebration of poetry for National Poetry Month here on A Public Affair today. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to hear from you with your own experiences of how poetry connects us, favorite poems or questions for the Poets Laureate here on our panel today. Let's talk a little bit more about reactions you all are hearing from people as you go out into communities in your various roles these days, and how people receive poetry in general in Wisconsin, but more broadly as well, if you'd like. And we heard that great story from Kimberly connecting with Indigenous poets in Washington, D.C. earlier. What is the audience for poetry these days that you encounter, and what are they saying about their interactions and need for poetry? Let's go back to you, Kimberly.
So I don't even know where to start, but I want to tag on to the focus that both Stephen and Nicholas were touching on, which is poetry in prisons.
Sure.
Because when I was Wisconsin Poet Laureate and following that, I was really privileged to work with a group that Nick Dembski, who was a librarian in Racine, had sort of worked with in the Racine Correctional Institute. And first, let me tell you, they have this great sense of humor besides just being a wonderful group. They call themselves the Pros and Cons. But visiting them originally to perform for them became us visiting them so they could perform for us. And I was really blown away at how powerful their writing was. And not only that, but how much they supported one another in this community of writing. It became for them this sort of lifeline. It kept them sane in their circumstances. I remember one of my very early visits. I'd love to tell you this long story about how I couldn't get into prison, but we'll save that. So ask me that sometime when we're having a drink. But in one of my first visits, when they were going to read to us, this one man got up and he had a significant stutter. And it concerned me that people were not going to be kind, gentle, receptive, you know, whatever. But in fact, it was exactly the opposite. They would say, "You got this. Oh, go ahead. You got it." And it was just not just that moment, but all the different ways they supported one another in that writing community. And I felt like there were maybe three people that, had they been able to come out of prison, could just blow the whole poetry world open. They were so good. And then there were people who were not great, but they were doing the thing, right, that we do, which is trying to put experience into words and trying to connect with other people through that. So that's, you know, one of my experiences with poetry in Wisconsin. But I forgot to say when I was talking about that most recent community poem, we opened it up and people from 32 countries contributed. So that kind of linking of voices, I think, is also really good for our creating understanding between different nations and different races and nationalities and all of that political leanings. So I do think that poetry has a role to play in creating community.
Stephen, we'll go right to you.
Yeah, so I mean, I haven't been, again, poet laureate for just a couple months now, but I have been really lucky enough to visit classes and hear from people at readings and things like that. For me, a poem, and this sort of like goes back to what Nick was saying earlier about the rejection of closure. I think that this is like a blank space where you can really work things out on the page without having that expectation of, again, closure or perfection or like an answer, right? And I think that was really exemplified by a recent event that I was able to read at called Formless. And that was through UW's Woodpack series. It's an annual event. Basically everyone came to the reading having just wrote the thing, right? Having just drafts of things. And that's not even just poems. I mean, we're talking like dance routines that are still in the making. We're talking songs. We're talking video essays and poems, things like that. And there's one thing about just like that level of vulnerability on the page of just like, hey, I haven't figured this out yet, but I understand it's valuable enough to like follow. But there's a whole other thing where you're just like, hey, I'm not even done with this, but I need you all to see it. And for me, that was like an incredibly vulnerable audience and a really memorable moment that happened recently.
I want to stay with you for just a second, Stephen, because I want to make sure we get to mention the Arts and Literature Laboratory, and I know you're involved there. Tell us a little bit more about that space as a venue for poetry these days in Madison.
Yeah. So Art Lit Lab is a great place, intersectional space, nonprofit for contemporary arts, including literature, but also visual and performing arts. We do a lot of monthly poetry readings here as part of our Watershed reading series. We highlight local and regional poets, but also poets that are traveling across the country to read at this thing. So it's a really great place to, again, form that connection and also sort of like gather, right? The Wisconsin Festival of Poetry just ended here. That is Winter Festival of Poetry just ended here. That is an 8-week celebration of poetry. I mean, it's a great venue. Come by. I'll personally give you a tour of the space. That's an invitation for anybody listening.
Thanks, Stephen. I will turn to you, Nicholas, with your current kind of initiatives with a Wisconsin Poet Laureate.
Yeah, so I oftentimes get asked, like, what's the best part of this position? And it's a very difficult, because there are so many wonderful parts. But I think for me, what I keep returning to when I'm thinking about my time as the poet laureate of the state where I was born is how different Wisconsin feels to me now as a community, as a state, than it did when I was young and starting to write and starting to fall in love with writing. I probably started writing when I was 12 or 13, so this dates me here a little bit, but so that's where we're thinking like 1992, 1993 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And but for a small group of creative friends that I had found and was lucky enough to find, I often felt like the only writer in the state when I thought about what poetry was or what literature was or what maybe by extension what art was. Wisconsin wasn't a place that came to mind. It was always something like New York, Chicago, maybe if we wanted to get to the Midwest, or Los Angeles, California, something like that. But Wisconsin felt so barren of that kind of culture. And then 30 years later, here I am driving every weekend to community, to small town, to places I didn't even know existed in Wisconsin. And this person runs a reading series out of their local coffee shop. And here are all these organizations that even like these organizations that make my position possible. Like we have the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts and Letters. We have the Arts and Lit Lab. We have the Council for Wisconsin Writers. We have the Wisconsin Art Board. We have the Wisconsin Fellowship for Poets. We have Wisconsin Humanities, the Center for the Book. We have the best poetry bookstore in the country in Milwaukee, Woodland Pattern, right on Door County, the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. There are all these kind of DIY, localized, grassroots conglomerations of people acting outside of the, for the most part, acting outside of the push and pull of capital. Like the people aren't running these organizations for money. They're doing it because they love art. They're doing it because they think that this activity, this strange activity that we call poetry, is important. And there are all these strangers in my state sacrificing their time, sacrificing their attention to create these spaces for writers that I had no sense of when I was young. And sometimes it can be difficult to be proud to be from Wisconsin. We have a lot of political and racial issues here. Sometimes when Wisconsin makes the news, it's not for reasons that I wish it would. But this position has provided me a window into my state that I haven't had before. And it's provided me a window into all of the kind of separate but unified communities of writers, both the supporters of writers and the writers themselves. And I think I could stay here for a while, you know?
Thank you, Nicholas, for that testimony of how your experience as Wisconsin Poet Laureate has changed you and changed your sense of the state. And I'm so glad we had the opportunity there to also just include all those great people and organizations that you've been collaborating with to give them a shout out here as well. That's definitely something I wanted to get to today, was the kind of infrastructure for poetry around the state. And you just talked about how big it truly is. Kim, I want to make sure we have time for you to briefly tell us a little bit more about another broad community of poetry that you've been involved in creating as founding director of INNAPO, Indigenous Nations Poets. And then if we have a couple minutes, we'll hear a couple poems to wrap up today after that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. So I began this organization because there were a lot of other organizations available for poets of color, but nothing for Indigenous poets. And I began right before the pandemic in 2020 and thought that this was going to be a garage band poetry org for a number of years. But there was a great need, and it turns out a great deal of support. So it sort of blasted into the world, and we have built ourselves with a lot of partnerships. And we've had a beautiful, beautiful, you know, bunch of programs. But it was originally created as an organization to support emerging Indigenous writers and to also nurture the growth of Indigenous poetic practices. And it really just raised the visibility of Native writers, both those that have come before and those that are upcoming. And one of the recent things we're doing is we're focusing on language back, the way that poetry can support the revitalization of Indigenous languages, and the way Indigenous languages carry so many so much wisdom and so many teachings that we need right now in the midst of the climate crisis. And so I think that's one of our huge initiatives, but also we have these annual retreats. And we just had one in Wisconsin. The first one was at DC with Joy Harjo when she closed out her term, but we had one in Wisconsin last year up at Bjorklunden. It was focused on eco-poetry. And we made, again, you know, here's the thing about poetry connecting with other arts and poetry building communities. We had some local people who collaborated with us to make beautiful poetry films called Poems for a Tattered Planet. So you can check out the NAPO YouTube channel and see one short film that features all of the fellows, some of the faculty and other community members participating in one poem, and then individual poems that were made by Stumptown Media and Overpass Light Brigade as they followed us around our days. But I think that NAPO is taking off crazily. Many of our first fellows are already having books come out. So it's a very great time, and I feel you know, really privileged to be able to support them.
Thanks for giving us some insight into your work and the evolving kind of many dimensions of NAPO, Indigenous Nations Poets. Kimberly Blazer, we're rapidly running out of time. I wish we had another hour, but I want to make sure we give poetry its due here by just wrapping up with a poem. And I wish we could hear another poem from each of you, but we're going to have to wrap here, and Stephen has voted for our current Wisconsin Poet Laureate, Nicholas Gulig, to take us out with a poem. And I also want to make sure, before I forget, to blurb a great upcoming event. You all mentioned Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. They've been doing this series, Bloom, A Season of Poetry. There's one event left in the series, which I'm really looking forward to, on May 23rd. Our guest today, Kimberly Blazer, is going to be in conversation with U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limón on May 23rd at 7 p.m. So check that out at the Overture. It's also hybrid if you're interested. Okay, Nick, I think 2 minutes is what we got here. Go for it. We're going to hear from Wisconsin Poet Laureate Nicholas Gulig.
Thanks. A question I often get asked is, what is a poem? Where do poems come from? And I didn't have a ready-made answer when I first became a poet laureate. So I wrote this poem called Craft Talk in an effort to answer that. Craft Talk. In the breath of the book, before the book, and after, in the blue periphery of after, in the aperture of speech, in the green infinity of reading, the bleak community of loss, in the terror of the margins blossoming, in the violence of the mind's arrival blossoming, in the perforated space of utterance, in the unnameable hallucinations of the alphabet, in the bright sobriety of awe, in the illuminated wake of wonder, a world unfurling in the mute cathedral of the interior, in the still uncertain music of the interior, in the porous borders of the image, in the day-glow ruins of the dictionary, in the pregnant lapse of reason, in the seedling gaps of exposition, in the song-drawn logic of the dream, in the beautiful collapse of the house of language, in the extravagant expanse of the house of language, in the structure of a garden's darkness, a mouth in the wilderness, the tongue unraveling, in the light that isn't light, in the open doorway of the eye.
That's Wisconsin Poet Laureate Nicholas Gulig. Thank you for joining us, Nicholas.
Of course, thanks for having me, and thanks to Kim and Stephen for all the work that they do.
We've also had with us Stephen Espada Dawson, Poet Laureate of Madison. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks for having us. This was so great.
And Kimberly Blazer has been with us as well, former Wisconsin Poet Laureate. Thanks for joining us, Kimberly.
It's been great. We should have another hour off mic.
I would love it. I'm your host, Douglas Haynes, and I'd like to thank today's engineer, Andrew Thomas, producer Jade Iseri Ramos, news director Shali Pittman and receptionist Amy Lutsky. If you've appreciated today's show, please share it using the Wharton Online Archive or wherever you find your podcasts. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison Community Supported Radio. Stay tuned for Madison Book Beat, continuing with National Poetry Month celebration here. We have today at 1 o'clock former Madison Poet Laureate Angie Trudell Vasquez, interviewed by Lisa Malofsky on Madison Book Beat. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. At the end of the opening day of his criminal trial in New York, Donald Trump has again accused President Biden of a witch hunt designed to keep him off the campaign trail ahead of November's elections. Inside court, prosecutors accused Mr. Trump of a conspiracy and a cover-up to hide payments he made to a porn actress in 2016 before he was elected. Here's Sarah Smith.
Michael Colangelo, the prosecuting lawyer, told the jury Mr. Trump had orchestrated a criminal scheme to corrupt the 2016 election, while the defendant just shook his head. Paying the porn star Stormy Daniels $130,000 in hush money was election fraud, said the prosecution. The first witness was David Pecker from the National Enquirer magazine. He was asked about buying up stories that were unfavourable to Mr. Trump, not so he could publish them, but so he could quash them to help Donald Trump's political campaign. The defense reminded the jury that Mr. Trump is innocent until proven guilty. They said his behavior wasn't criminal. There's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy.
Police in Ecuador have